This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. It's estimated that 1 in 8 women will develop breast cancer during her lifetime. That number is expected to go up over the next 15 years, according to the National Cancer Institute. And baby boomers, in particular, will be hit the hardest. This hour, we bring you the latest on screening, treatment, and prevention. And also, we'll talk about the recent controversies regarding mammograms and home test kits for the BRCA genes. And, of course, we'll take your questions and comments. Our guests this hour are Susan Domchek, Executive Director of the Vassar Research Center for BRCA at Abramson Cancer Center of the University of Pennsylvania. She's also a professor of medicine. Susan, welcome.
Thank you.
And Generosa Grana is director at the MD Anderson Cancer Center at Cooper Health System, where she heads hematology and medical oncology at Cooper University Hospital, also a professor of medicine at Cooper Medical School of Rowan University, and a breast cancer survivor. Welcome, Generosa.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, as just said, the number of women who are expected to develop breast cancer is expected to go up by about 50% over 15 years. Why is that?
To begin with, we are aging as a population, and the risk of breast cancer increases as women age. So that's a large part of the burden of cancer that we're going to see in the next 20 to 30 years, and how we deal with that, how we adapt our early detection strategies to identify these cancers, how we develop treatment strategies for these women will be really critical.
There are a number of other factors as well. Some of the more Western society strategies and lifestyle effects are very significant. So, for instance, obesity is a major risk factor for the development of breast cancer. For any individual woman, it's a small risk factor, but over a population, if obesity is common, it really adds up. That lack of exercise and hormonal risk factors, such as having your period late or period early, which is common in Western countries who are well-nourished, having your children late, and taking hormone replacement therapy after menopause are all risk factors. So when you tie all that together, obesity and reproductive risk factors and an aging population, you really do get a boom in the total number of breast cancer cases.
Have you found that the number of women who are taking hormone replacement therapy has declined, especially when the risks that were publicized, what, about 10 years ago?
That's absolutely true. So after the big Women's Health Initiative study, which was a randomized study of women who would take hormone replacement therapy versus not, there really was a change in hormone replacement usage in the United States. However, as always, the devil's in the details. So there are a few facts about that study, one of which is the risk was seen with combination hormone replacement therapy, estrogen with progesterone and not estrogen alone. And the second issue is that those were older women, so the average age was around 63 in people who entered the study. So there is still, if you will, debate around the margins, those early women who are just going into menopause or the types of hormone replacement therapy. So there's still work to be done, and it's still something to talk to your doctors about. But certainly the overuse of estrogen replacement therapy or the general assumption that everyone should take it has really gone by the wayside.
So in general, as the number of women who develop breast cancer is expected to go up overall, at the same time I read that the death rate from breast cancer has been falling over the last 20 years. So there's some good news here.
Very good news. And it's both in the United States and other Western countries. England has the same data where we're seeing a significant impact on mortality, greater numbers of survivors in our population, largely due to screening and early detection, but also better treatment for the disease, better hormonal therapies, better identification of who needs chemotherapy and what particular chemotherapy, advent of new drugs such as pertuzumab for the woman who's HER2-new positive. So we've really seen a nice shift in survivorship from breast cancer. What we're also seeing, though, is a larger population of survivors who have needs pertaining to survivorship and health factors and survivorship. So it is an important improvement.
Let's get to screening and some of the headlines recently. For those of us who have dutifully gone and gotten our mammograms every year since the age of 40, there's word now that this might not be necessary. A panel of independent medical experts has determined that breast cancer screening should begin at 50 for most women. So what's your reaction to that?
Now, you have to know from the get-go that you're talking to two biased women here who,
okay.
who are breast cancer doctors, and we both see a large number of young women with breast cancer. So we have to say that up front. One of the real challenges is that mammography helps some women, but we're not very good at figuring out exactly who it helps. And because the risk of breast cancer goes up as you get older, when you have sort of a higher risk of breast cancer in that year, mammography is going to benefit you more. In younger women, the risk of breast cancer is lower, and so it's harder to sort of see those benefits. So I think that it's a real challenge. We need to do a better job figuring out who's at risk and then targeting our screening to those women. So I think we have to be careful not to sort of be dismissive about it. We see a lot of young women who haven't been able to get mammography because they're under 40 and now are presenting with locally advanced tumors. And it's worth saying that there's a difference between surviving your cancer, where we may be able to make up for a later stage diagnosis with excellent chemotherapy or hormonal therapy, and being diagnosed at an earlier stage where you may not need as much treatment. So all of those things also need to be factored in.
So this determination can affect insurance coverage eventually?
Possibly. Mm-hmm. You know, if the guidelines really go into effect saying that we will cover mammography starting at 50, that could be playing a role. Thus far, it hasn't. And I think the debate continues. And there's still a lot of debate as to the right recommendations to make. The U.S. Preventive Health Services Task Force guidelines were put out, but no one has changed the recommendations. What I think has happened, though, is that there's been more discussion about risk with women, hopefully. And as you assess risk, you can better determine how you need to screen that woman. For some women, mammography alone is not enough. If you're a high-risk woman, for some of those women, we recommend screening MRI as an adjunct to mammography. For some women, genetic testing needs to be considered along with screening. For some women, preventive strategies such as drugs, raloxifene, tamoxifen need to be considered for risk reduction. So my hope is that we've opened the dialogue and that this whole discussion about timing of mammography opens up into a bigger forum around risk assessment and prevention.
How do you know if you're high risk?
The first thing is to look at your family history and to really take a deep look at the family history, not just who's had, has there been breast cancer, but specifically who had the breast cancer, at what age, one breast or both breasts, was there ovary in the family, and Susan is really the expert in this field. But then also your clinician should be looking with you at other risk factors. So we should be looking at when you started your period, when you had your first child, whether you've had any biopsies. That can all be collated into a risk model, and there are models that women can actually do themselves online.
Now, one of the additional challenges is that the best risk factor information is for a specific type of breast cancer that's estrogen receptor positive. But estrogen receptor negative breast cancer is more common in younger women, and we actually don't have as good of a sense for what those risk factors are. So it gets back to the idea that research is important and further refining of risk factors is critically important. So if we're going to drop mammography, we need to know who should be getting it. And so we need to kind of go back to the drawing board and saying, who is at risk for estrogen receptor negative breast cancer? Who should be getting screening at a younger age? We talk a lot about genetics, and it's what I do, and I enjoy it greatly. But most women who develop breast cancer do not have a single identifiable gene mutation. So it's not all about genetics. It's a piece of it. It's an important piece of it, especially for an individual's decision making, but it's not the whole thing.
You mentioned research. Is the research money there?
Well, breast cancer is fortunate to be an area where there is a reasonable amount of research funding. We all want more research money, so let's get right at that. We're fortunate in the breast cancer field to not only have money from the National Cancer Institute, but the Department of Defense, and then local organizations, philanthropic organizations like the Kalman Foundation and the Breast Cancer Research Foundation. And I have been fortunate for the Vassar Research Center to have funding. However, you need to go back to basic science to understand a lot of those first principles. And that's where I would say that the sequestering and the issues with the budget and that National Institutes of Health can really take a toll, because if you don't understand basic principles of why cancers form, it's harder to come up with these risk factors or preventative strategies.
Mm. So the American Cancer Society still recommends yearly screening for women beginning at 40. And I'm gathering that you agree with that. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I very much agree with that for the moment. But I do think it has to be combined with a discussion with the woman about the rationale, the possibility of finding abnormalities, and what that would mean. So I think it's not just a blanket statement, get your mammogram at age 40, but yes, get your mammogram at age 40, but here's why, and here are the potential downfalls, and maybe based on your risk, we should do more.
I've also read that breast self-exam might not be as effective as it was once thought to be. You're nodding your head?
Yes, that is something that has been shown. There was a big study in China where women were randomly assigned to do self-breast exams versus not, and it really didn't change what happened to those women overall in terms of breast cancer.
So is it hard then to really determine a cancer in the tiniest stage? Is that the issue?
The issue is that most of what very young women feel in their breasts is not cancer. They're benign findings. They're things like fibroadenomas, or it's just benign breast tissue. So it can cause a lot of anxiety and concern and unnecessary tests. But on the other hand, I'm very a big fan of knowing what your breasts feel like, because changes are important, and women do often detect their own cancers. But it's not necessarily on a regimented schedule of, you know, every first day of the month when I do my exam. What people report is that they were in the shower, or they bumped into something and then they felt something. But because they knew what their breasts felt like, they knew it was new. And I think that's the important thing, is to know what your breasts feel like in general. And then if something comes up, then to get it evaluated.
So bottom line is, how often should you screen yourself or do self-exam?
I still think it's a useful tool to think about on a monthly basis if you can remember. And I particularly like breast self-exam for the high-risk woman,
right,
because it's a very cheap tool. And it keeps her alert to her breast health. So these are often women that may not be getting a regular mammogram because they're too young. They really could benefit from this. But again, the literature suggests that there is no clinical benefit.
It is one of those things that it's very cheap to have someone examine their own breasts. So the real downside, if you will, is having unnecessary tests. So that's why if you feel something, you go to your physician, you have it evaluated, and most of those can be put to rest easily.
All right, more in a moment. Our focus this hour is on breast cancer, the latest in treatment and prevention. Our guests, Generosa Grana is director at the MD Anderson Cancer Center at Cooper Health System and a breast cancer survivor, and Susan Domchek is executive director of the Vassar Research Center for BRCA at the University of Pennsylvania. Lines are open if you'd like to join the conversation. 888-477-9499. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. Our guests are Susan Domchek, executive director of the Vassar Research Center for BRCA at the University of Pennsylvania, and Generosa Grana is director at the MD Anderson Cancer Center at Cooper Health System. If you have questions or comments, feel free to give us a call at 888-477-9499. Our email is radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Remember, our guests are unable to dispense medical advice directly. So, wanted to get back to the headlines for just one more moment. The new study in the Annals of Internal Medicine suggests that women with dense breasts are not necessarily at higher risk for breast cancer. That's new.
Well, let's talk about breast density for a moment. We've long known that women who have dense breast tissue on mammography both have a slight increased risk of breast cancer in general, and also that mammography is a little less effective at finding breast cancers. And that's been known for a while, but the devil, again, is in the details, which is, how do you assess breast density reproducibly time and time again on different mammography machines and things like that. So that's been an ongoing source of debate and study. But layered onto this, many states then passed legislation that said that you had to inform patients of that breast density, and Pennsylvania is one of those states. And so it's been confusing for patients and providers alike to know, okay, now that you know someone has dense breast tissue, what do you do about it? So on top of that comes this study today, which suggests that if you have breast dense tissue, that your risk comes if you also have other risk factors. And so I think that's an important component. It's not just the breast density. It seems to be other risk factors that go along with it that makes you at the highest risk.
And it gets back to this model that we talked about. There's a model that a woman can do online called the GAIL model, G-A-I-L. It's a risk calculating tool, and you put in information about the woman's age, her reproductive history, when she had her first period, when she had her first child, whether she has first-degree relatives with breast cancer, and her ethnicity. And it then calculates risk. And the study that was published suggests that it is women who have an increased GAIL model risk along with either heterogeneous or diffusely dense breast tissue that have that higher lifetime risk of developing breast cancer. So it is a useful tool for clinicians to think about in terms of putting the two tools together, both breast density and other risk factors, to compile a risk for the individual woman. Now, what we still don't know is, what do you do with that? Are these women that should be getting MRI for additional imaging? Will that help? Are these women that should be considered for chemo prevention with drugs like tamoxifen or Evista? Those are possibilities, but we don't have the concrete answers, and research needs to be done to help us.
Not every woman who is at risk for breast cancer needs genetic screening, correct? Who should go and explore that avenue?
That's correct. The standard based on the U.S. Preventative Task Force and the National Comprehensive Cancer Center Network suggests that women who have a strong family history of breast or ovarian cancer should consider testing. In addition, there are certain groups of patients who are always eligible for genetic testing. Those include all women with ovarian cancer. So I'm going to say that again. If a woman is diagnosed with ovarian cancer, she is a candidate for genetic testing, and in fact, it's recommended. You know, any woman with early onset breast cancer under age 45, any man with breast cancer, we sometimes forget about the men, mm-hmm. and there are a number of other very clear criteria. There's a lot of debate about whether those criteria should be lower still. And any woman, for instance, who is of Ashkenazi Jewish descent with breast or ovarian cancer is a candidate for genetic testing. But there's now a lot of discussion about whether anyone who's of Ashkenazi Jewish descent, period, should be a candidate for genetic testing. And that's still sort of in process and figuring out how to do that and whether to do that. But these are things that are ongoing at this time.
I'd like to take a telephone call from Samantha right now in South Philadelphia, because I think this question is germane to the discussion. Welcome, Samantha.
Hi. I'm a two-time ovarian cancer survivor and a patient of Dr. Domchek. Hi, doctor. And I wanted to ask, you talked about it a little bit about ovarian cancer, but if you can talk a little bit about the connection between ovarian cancer and breast cancer and what a woman with high risk should do for breast cancer, and just remind them that they're also at risk for ovarian cancer.
Thank you. Thanks, Samantha.
Yeah, it's a great point. The evidence that we have to date is that women who have breast cancer, that if their genetic testing is negative and there's no family history of ovarian cancer in their family, that they're at really about the same risk for ovarian cancer as the general population, which is about a 1-2% lifetime risk of ovarian cancer. So we're not saying that people who have had breast cancer or negative genetic testing aren't at risk for ovarian cancer. It's just that there's no good evidence that there's a significant elevation. Having said that, we are getting more and more sophisticated with our genetic testing all the time. And whereas before, BRCA1 and BRCA2 were the two genes that we all talked about and thought about, we now know about other genes. Some of these genes we know a lot about. Some of these genes we know much less about. There is testing available for all of these, but there's some issues with that testing too. It's not all, if you will, a free lunch, and it's not all straightforward. So we do talk to individuals about the types of genetic testing and what we can find to help sort of make have people make the right decisions and know what they're at risk for.
And while we're talking about testing, the home test kits that we heard about a couple of weeks ago that are on the market for testing for the BRCA genes, what do you think?
So these tests, at least my understanding of these tests, is that women can go online and ask for these tests to be ordered. They are ordered by a physician, but in this one case, the physician is provided, if you will, by the company. I think that the really important thing about genetic testing is that it is part of your overall medical care. It should not be felt as sort of something separate that you do, if you will, on the sly without your regular doctors knowing about it. It's crucially important. If you are found to have a result that might influence your medical care, you want your doctors to know about it. In addition, there are findings that you can get on genetic testing that can be quite disturbing. There are findings that we call variants of unknown significance, changes in the genetic code that we don't know whether they're important or not. And there are certain genes that if we found them, we would be surprised, but they would have major implications for your health. An example we give here is there's a gene called CDH1, which is associated with a very, very high risk of stomach cancer. And we wouldn't expect to find it in someone who doesn't have a family history of stomach cancer. But if we do, we're suddenly faced with the prospect of maybe removing someone's healthy stomach to prevent cancer. These are not trivial. So I feel very strongly that genetic testing should be done within the context of informed consent, knowing what you're getting into, and as part of your general medical care.
I absolutely agree, and really combined with counseling, because first of all, you need to determine what test to do, what's appropriate for the woman based on her personal history, based on her family history. But secondly, a negative test does not necessarily mean that a woman is not at increased risk and does not need to be managed differently, because genetics is evolving and what is negative is changing. So I agree with Susan that in today's world, the ideal testing should be done in collaboration with a team that can provide information that can help select the test and that can give you guidance as to what to do with the results.
Back to the BRCA genes for just a moment and the Angelina effect. Angelina Jolie, most of us know, had prophylactic mastectomies and also recently had her ovaries removed as well because her mother had passed away from ovarian cancer. Is there a trend now for too many prophylactic mastectomies? When is that needed? I've read of women who may not necessarily be at risk, but still just say, you know what? Get rid of it. I don't want to have to worry about this 10 years down the road. What are your thoughts?
We spend a lot of time discussing prophylactic mastectomies in different scenarios. So on the one hand, you have the woman who has a striking family history or a woman who has a known mutation. And in those women, I think most people feel that the approach makes complete sense as long as the woman is informed, aware of options, and knows that that's one of the options. So I think that's an easier scenario. A more difficult scenario is the case where a woman who has a cancer, no strong family history, no other worrisome things, but is worried enough about the opposite breast that she chooses to have a contralateral mastectomy for prevention. And we've seen a significant increase in that across the country. 12 to 15% of women are now choosing bilateral mastectomies when they could have chosen a lumpectomy or a unilateral mastectomy. Many physicians spend a lot of time with those women educating them to make sure they're really aware of their choices, to make sure that they're pursuing the surgical decision on the right basis.
It's major surgery.
It's major surgery. It's reconstruction is good, but it's not perfect. And oftentimes, it will not change that woman's life expectancy. It will change her need for future imaging of the opposite breast. It may change her level of concern about the opposite breast, but it will not change survival because her survival is often dictated by the outcome of the original cancer that she's being treated for. And that's a difficult discussion to have with patients.
It is very difficult, and sometimes I worry that we as providers don't do a good enough job communicating all of these complicated facts. Obviously, any woman can make a decision about the value to her of having a bilateral mastectomy versus more localized surgery. However, when studies have been done, it seems like a lot of women think that the benefit is more than there is, that they feel that having had the bilateral mastectomy will make it more likely that they'll survive the cancer they have. And that's actually not true. So we just have to make sure that when women are going into this surgery, that they understand sort of the potential benefit, which is, again, reduction in imaging and a decrease in the development of cancer on the other side, but also the potential risks and limitations. And one of those is that women's risk of developing a cancer on the other side is rarely as high as they think it is. And that's just something we need to do a better job communicating.
Okay, continuing with our telephone calls. John in Haddonfield, New Jersey. You're live on Radio Times. Hi, John.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi. Thank you very much. My question has to do with the lifestyle factors that contribute to cancers as we understand them now. Increasingly, we're seeing that a sedentary lifestyle coupled with a highly processed diet is a recipe for increased risk of all cancers. I know particularly in men, colorectal cancer and prostate cancer. Most of the conversation today has focused on testing and detection, but particularly for young women, these preventative lifestyles or habits in the lifestyle could yield serious benefit in the long run. Sleep, activity, and dietary measures, you know, do you think will yield benefits
to
reducing cancer incidence?
We appreciate the call to Radio Times, John. Thanks.
I think that's very helpful. There has been studies that have shown that both in terms of risk of developing breast cancer and also looking at risk of recurrence for women who have had breast cancer, that exercise is protective. In a large California study, there was a very significant impact from a diet that was low in fat, high in exercise content. So we know in generalities that exercise is protective, that alcohol is detrimental. More than one alcoholic drink per day may increase risk. But beyond that, we know very little about what specific strategies are helpful, what specific nutritional supplements, if any. So I do spend a lot of time with my patients talking about weight loss, physical activity, alcohol. These are hard conversations. Women don't necessarily want to focus as much on that as they do on taking a pill. These are hard lifestyle changes that need to be embarked upon, but I think they're very important. And they're also, I think, incredibly important for our young girls, making sure that they're staying lean and thin and active. It delays the onset of puberty, which is protective in terms of breast cancer risk. But number two, it probably has significant impact on lifelong health. And I think it's something we need to focus on.
And how about environmental factors?
Well, I think this is the challenge, is that the environmental factors beyond those that Jenny mentioned are much less understood. I think we all counsel our patients on sort of having a healthy diet, and by that, high fruits and vegetables and minimally processed foods and lean meats. But that's also because breast cancer survivors can have issues with heart issues and bone health. And so we're trying to keep sort of overall healthy diets. The data has not been as striking as we would have hoped on those specific dietary interventions, but they do help with obesity as well. So it's all tied together. And one of the challenges in the breast cancer literature is because exercise and obesity and diet are so all closely linked with each other, it can be hard to separate one specific thing out. People are really interested in other environmental factors, pesticides, things like that. We just honestly don't know enough. You would think we'd know more by now. But remember, especially in the United States, people move. They have different exposures over different times in their life. And particularly with breast cancer, it probably is an exposure at a certain time that really makes the difference. And those are really hard things to pull apart.
There are some interesting studies going on now following adolescent girls that will both look at puberty, hormonal factors, but also look at obesity, and potentially they're following lots of environmental pollutants and other things in those young girls. So I think the future is going to be ripe with that kind of information, but we're really flying oftentimes with without that.
We have an email from Gwen who says, please do not let this great show end without your experts mentioning the existence of little-known inflammatory breast cancer and what women should look for to identify it. Thank you.
Inflammatory breast cancer is a very important entity. It's not common, 1.5-2% of breast cancer or thereabouts, but it is a very clear presentation. A woman will have a large red, tender breast, often gets confused with an abscess or infection, but in reality, it is just the tumor in the breast that's involving the lymphatic channels of the skin. Often a diagnosis that presents with little warning, no palpable mass that was there for a long time, just this presentation. And it is an aggressive cancer that requires a combined approach. So you need chemotherapy often as your first approach, mastectomy, post-mastectomy radiation. The chemotherapy depends on what type of cancer it is as to whether things like Herceptin are added or not. But it is an important thing for women to be about learning about.
Especially because if you have a hot red breast, sometimes those are infections. So we do want to make that clear. Not every issue.
For instance, if you're breastfeeding.
Correct. Yeah. So the issue is just not to let it go. So if the decision is made with your doctor that it does seem to be likely infection, that's fine. You start the antibiotics. But if it's no better, then you need to move to stage two and make sure that it's nothing else.
Let's get back to prevention for just a moment. Is breastfeeding preventive? Does it help to prevent breast cancer?
There are good data that breastfeeding does help prevent breast cancer, and we should have actually mentioned that along with the other reproductive factors. One of the things is, though, that you get your effect really after about a year of breastfeeding. And in the United States, again, that's not that common. So it's this combination of Western reproductive factors that we delay our childbearing, we don't breastfeed for as long, we don't have as many children. And these are good things in many ways, but they are risk factors for breast cancer.
Okay, our guests are Susan Domchek, Executive Director of the Basser Research Center for BRCA at the University of Pennsylvania, and Jenny Grana is Director of the MD Anderson Cancer Center at Cooper Health System. Our telephone number is 888-477-9499. Remember, our guests cannot dispense personal medical advice on the show, but feel free to give us a call with your questions or comments. We will be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowane. Our guests are Jenny Grana, director at the MD Anderson Cancer Center at Cooper Health System, and Susan Domchek, executive director of the Basser Research Center for BRCA at the University of Pennsylvania. And again, if you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 888-477-9499, or you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Jenny, you are a breast cancer survivor, so let's spend a couple moments talking about your story.
I was diagnosed at age 49 when I went for my routine mammogram, it was clearly evident an area of microcalcifications about a centimeter in size. That was obvious to me as I'm sitting there looking at the mammogram, so I was not surprised. I have no family history. I have the same risk factors most women do. Only one I can think of really clearly was later childbirth. It was not shocking to me. I see it every day.
It wasn't shocking to me.
I think it was just a why not me kind of moment. I was very fortunate. I had a lot of support. My patients were amazing in terms of their support of me. I felt very, very fortunate. And I've moved on, continued to do what I do. And in many ways, I think it made me a better doctor. I think it made me much more aware of the emotional and physical issues that my patients go through.
So do you tell your patients?
I don't have this conversation when I'm seeing a new patient, but most of my patients have somehow found out about it. It's out there. I was not particularly out about it, nor private about it. So many patients know about it, will ask me questions, but I try to keep it from the discussion with the individual patient because I don't want it to affect their decision-making. I don't want my decisions about treatment to be an issue as the patient is making decisions about their own treatment.
So the emotional piece of it, how do you advise your patients?
it takes its toll. It definitely raises issues of about body image and risk and susceptibility. But
mortality.
But I think it is an issue that I think is empowering. So I really want patients to think about survivorship and the journey ahead of them. I think it also empowered me to do different things. So I don't look at it all as a negative experience. I think it's taught my daughter some important lessons, my children some important lessons. So it's okay.
Okay, let's get to the phones. Nicole in Newtown Square, you're live on Radio Times. Welcome.
Hi. I'm 72 years old, and I've had a mammogram every year since I was 40. And thank heaven, I've never had a positive result, but I've had many, many false positives. I have dense breasts, and sometimes I think I'll die of fear before I ever die of anything else. I wonder, what kind of progress are we making in actually reading these mammograms, being able to detect the range of what is normal, especially in a dense breast?
Oh, that's a great question, Nicole. Thanks for calling. And you are nodding your head, Susan Domchak.
Well, I actually think it brings up one of the points that the U.S. Preventive Task Force has brought up, which is that many, many more women have false positive results than end up being diagnosed with cancer. And it is incredibly anxiety provoking, and we do need to do a better job at minimizing the false positives. So there are things that are on the way or here. Tomosynthesis, which is sort of a 3D mammography, has the potential to decrease callbacks and minimize false positives. There's some early work that suggests that that's so. There's other imaging techniques that are coming down the pike. So I think the idea will be that if we can minimize the false positives, we also minimize a lot of the harm of mammography.
And the harm, I think, is important to recognize because in your case, you've been diligent and you've continued to get your mammograms. But some women, as they get their false positive, that fear keeps them from being proactive in the future. So it is an important factor to recognize.
We have a question from Claire. She asks, if a female in her 60s has very swollen, sore lymph nodes in her armpit and groins, would it be appropriate to see a breast cancer doctor or someone else?
For that, given that the lymph nodes are in multiple places, starting with your primary care physician would actually be most recommended.
Absolutely. Because again, when you think of breast cancer, you think of lymph nodes under the arm and the axilla, but that wouldn't give you the groin lymph nodes, and other things should be considered. Some of them are pure inflammatory or infectious, but some of them can be malignant. Lymphomas can present in such a way. So I think primary care is the best way.
When in doubt, see your physician.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
All right. So there are different types of breast cancer, obviously, and there are all sorts of terminology. So in layman's terms, if you could give us a few quick definitions, and you'd mentioned this earlier, estrogen, is it estrogen positive, negative? What does this
mean?
Well,
we've come a long way. We used to think of breast cancer as two categories, estrogen positive and estrogen negative, meaning it has an expression of estrogen receptors or not. And then we learned about HER2 new positive breast cancer. So we had a third category that overexpresses this HER2 new protein. But over the last 5 or so years, we've probably now know that there are at least 8 to 10 variations of breast cancer based on subtypes. And they may have differences in biologic behavior. Susan can talk about these basal or triple negative basal cancers that one often sees in mutation positive women. So what we now know is that the genetic profile of a cancer, and I don't mean BRCA1 or 2, but just the genetic alterations that occur in a cancer can tell us a lot about the subtype of cancer and its behavior. We now have some tests that take advantage of that information that we're using to make decisions about treatment. Something like Oncotype, which is a test that's done in early stage breast cancer, takes advantage of that genetic profiling to give us useful information to plan treatment.
So we really try to emphasize to patients that there's not one type of breast cancer. There's multiple types. And when they're talking to family and friends about, you know, why you got this therapy and not that therapy, it's because there's multiple types of breast cancer and we treat them differently. And one of the most exciting things that's happened in the past, you know, 10 or 15 years is that we've really developed targeted therapies to some of these different subtypes. So we've made huge progress in estrogen receptor positive therapies because we have a number of different hormonal therapies that we can give, and we have new drugs that are different that target some of the estrogen resistance pathways that can be given with those hormonal therapies. On the other side of the coin, the HER2-new therapeutics, we have a bunch of drugs, trastuzumab, pertuzumab, lapatinib, we name them things that are annoying.
That nobody else can pronounce.
And a drug called T-DM1, which I can't actually pronounce that one, so I just call it T-DM1. But we have all these drugs that we can now give for HER2-new cancers, which used to be the worst cancer, but now we have all these things that target them specifically. What we still need to work on is to get more targeted therapies for the triple negative breast cancers. And some subset of the triple negative cancers are associated with BRCA1 mutations, and we are starting to develop therapies. And one therapy was just approved in December for ovarian cancer related to BRCA1 and 2 mutations that specifically targets the genetic defect in the cells. And that's very, very exciting.
And that's on the horizon. That's cutting edge. Gene therapy.
Well, it's not gene therapy. It's establishing that cancer occurred because of a specific gene mutation that you were born with, and then saying, I can target the problems in that cell that were caused by that gene mutation, and then using a different drug. So these drugs are called PARP inhibitors, and the first one, olaparib, was approved in a very specific situation, advanced ovarian cancer related to BRCA1 and 2 mutations in women who'd received multiple lines of chemotherapy already. But there's many ongoing trials, many different PARP inhibitors, and we definitely anticipate that those drugs will be used more widely in BRCA1 and 2 associated cancers, both breast cancer, ovarian cancer, and potentially other cancers. We haven't talked about it, but BRCA1 and 2 mutations are also associated with pancreatic cancer and prostate cancer, so it has implications beyond that. And these drugs can also are likely going to be used in ovarian cancer patients, even who don't have these BRCA1 and 2 mutations, because under the molecular basis of them is very similar to the BRCA1 and 2. And that's what Jenny was getting at. The more we understand molecularly and genetically what's going on in those cells, then we can figure out the targets that are most appropriate.
If a woman wants to participate in a clinical trial, what does she do?
I think the most important thing is if she has an oncologist, if she is a cancer patient and she has an oncologist, is to talk to her physician to try to get help identifying appropriate clinical trials for her, because there are certain things that are important when looking for a trial. What's your stage of disease? Are you in remission? Do you have progression? Do you have measurable disease? So there, it's not just, I'm going to look for a trial. There's some work to be done. And oftentimes, the oncologist is a good start. Other than that, looking at the NCI.gov site for clinical trials, tedious. Lots and lots, thousands of trials are on that site, and it often becomes difficult for the patient to try to weed it out. Some of the patients support the organizations, so Living Beyond Breast Cancer, breastcancer.org, and others are helpful in guiding women through that search for clinical trials.
All right, let's get to Nancy. Nancy is standing by in North Wales, Pennsylvania. Hello, Nancy.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You mentioned something earlier, the clinician did, and I'm sorry I forgot the doctor's name, that late life delivery, I have an 18-month-year-old daughter, and I'm 48, has something to do with the possibility of increased breast cancer risk. And I'm wondering if that is true, and if you can explain to me why.
Jenny?
So, yes, late first birth. So late first birth is a well-recognized risk factor, and it's debated whether what you consider late is 30 or 35, but clearly above that, having that be your first birth increases a woman's risk of breast cancer. And there's been a lot of work trying to understand that. It seems to be related to the breast having sort of unopposed estrogen exposure, whether it's related to some of the hormones of pregnancy. I don't know that we understand it completely well, but it is a well-known risk factor.
Now, to put it in context, it's not a striking risk factor. So for any individual woman, that risk, the relative risk, we call it, is only about 1.5 to up to 2, which is actually a very modest risk factor. So it, for an individual woman, that alone is not going to very significantly change her risk. It's just that if you take, I don't know how many people are in the U.S. now, 250 million, something like that, if you take a very large group of women who are all delaying childbirth, then that adds up.
Sure. And again, I think you have to counterbalance that with the joy of having a child. I don't think this is not something that you should be fearful of. I think it is something that your clinician should be aware of in the context of the other factors in your life.
Thanks for the call to Radio
Times.
Get my
mammograms. Thank you so much.
Okay, let's head to Cape May, New Jersey. And Mary, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi,
Mary.
Thank you for taking my call. Yes, sure. I'm here. Can you hear me?
We sure can. What's your question?
Okay, I am somewhat aware there are other types of diagnostic tests, as not only the typical mammogram that we have been used to, but 3D mammography, and I guess that is it, unless there is another one that I'm not aware of. But can you speak to that, or is it going to be more available, because at the moment it is not covered by insurance and it's not readily available? Is there any value, any benefit?
Okay. And also, too, thanks, Mary. Let's throw in just a comment from Bonnie about thermography as a healthier option to mammography, according to Bonnie. So both of those, please.
So I will not comment on thermography. And
thanks
I'll
a
let
lot,
Susan
Jenny.
Do that. But in terms of the 3D, actually, that's what we think of as tomosynthesis. There is another technique called contrast-enhanced breast imaging, which adds almost like a contrast like you would get for a CAT scan, but it's used with mammography. So that may be a value, not as a screening tool, but really as a diagnostic tool. MRI is an important both screening and diagnostic tools. And I look to the future for improvements in each of these areas. Again, Penn is doing some studies on sort of low-dose MR. The field is moving quickly, and I think we will have better tools. The idea is to have a high detection rate, but to lower the false positive rate.
Susan?
And to emphasize that, when I'm talking to my patients who have teenage daughters and they're worried about when their daughter should start imaging and things like that, I say, by the time your daughters get to the point that we need to be doing imaging, who knows what we'll be doing? I think that the field is changing. not to avoid the thermography question, but it's complicated. The data, there have been some early studies that people have been really interested in. There are some challenges from the standpoint of what we call localization, which is when you need to be able to know exactly where something is to then go biopsy it if you find an abnormality. And so I think that that is one of the imaging techniques that's under study that people are very interested in, but is not something that we have been doing on a regular basis clinically.
And one quick question. We've got about 45 seconds left. Metastatic breast cancer, quite often with today's treatments, you can live a full life.
We think of it as a chronic disease in many ways. It varies a lot based on where it presents, how it presents. But I think it's a time of hope for women with metastatic disease based on all the new therapies.
I think the critical thing is to keep doing the research to understand which cancers will respond best to which drugs and give people as much quality of time as we possibly can.
All right. Good hour, Susan Domchek. It was a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Susan is Executive Director of the Basser Research Center for BRCA at Abramson Cancer Center of the University of Pennsylvania. And Jenny Grana, great to have you here as well.
Thank you so much.
Jenny is Director at the MD Anderson Cancer Center at Cooper Health System, where she heads hematology and medical oncology at Cooper University Hospital. Don't forget, when you have the chance, check out our Facebook page and podcasts by visiting whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Kevin Griffin. Our producers are Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain on Radio Times. Thanks for joining us.